This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The year 2012 started out strangely. In Rapid City, South Dakota, it was 73 degrees Fahrenheit, about 23 Celsius, in the first week of January. That was hotter than Miami, which only reached 69 degrees. It was 61 in Boston, for heaven's sakes. The first week of January was warmer in Calgary, Canada, than in Disneyland, California. After a colder-than-usual start to the summer in Australia, everybody was complaining about that. In late December, Western Australia hit 49 degrees C. That's 120 degrees in the shade. Too hot to stand it. Is it global warming? Unlike the climate deniers, who flourish in every cold spell and then go under a rock in the heat, I can't be sure this is climate change. Meteorologist Jeff Masters over at the Weather Underground attributes some of the weird weather to changes in something called the Arctic Oscillation. Find that link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But I do know, these warm winters will become normal in 10 or 20 years if we go on polluting the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. Now we are going to talk about real climate. One of the joys of being a green host, I get to go deep with some of the world's best scientists. First, we're heading out on a journey through deep time, right up to the future, with Australia's Dr. Andrew Glickson. Then we have a brief chat with another scientist you should meet, Professor William Calvin from Washington State. I'm Alex Smith. Are you ready for Radio EcoShock? What will the future climate be like? Why do mass extinctions happen, and is one happening right now? To know what Earth is capable of, we must look into the deep past of our little planet. We're going on a voyage into the life of Earth through the eyes of one of Australia's most eminent scientists. Dr. Andrew Glickson reads rocks to find important stories that you were not taught in school, that we need to know. Andrew Glickson was the principal research scientist for the Australian Geological Survey Organization. Now he works with the Australian National University and the Planetary Science Institute. I am your host, Alex Smith. I've been receiving and studying Andrew Glickson papers for years. He's one of my mentors. So it is a pleasure to welcome you, Andrew, to this Radio EcoShock program.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me on.
Andrew, we may be living in a pivotal time for our species and our planet, but I want to start with a small detail that our listeners will notice. You don't sound like a typical Australian. Why not?
Well, in a way I am, because since 1964 I have travel right through the country and mapped its geology and known the outback quite well as any Australian. But you're correct. I have an accent. My father was from Germany, my mother from Latvia, and so the story goes on.
And do you go out pretty well every year? Do you spend a lot of time in the bush?
Until 4 years ago, I went every year virtually for several months. Since then, much of my work is now to do with climate and also exploration of subterranean structures buried deep in the earth, which means we use remote sensing, geophysical and geochemical methods.
So why is Australia good for hunting up the past?
Australia, or much of it, the center and the west, is a very stable continent, which means the formations, geological formations, have been preserved all the way back to about 3.6 billion years ago. And in some areas, they're very well preserved to the extent that we still have the original texture, the original chemistry and isotope composition of these materials, especially in Western Australia, which allows us to decipher the history of the Earth going back that far in time.
And why did you move beyond geology to develop your interest in past mass extinction events and the climate?
Yes, well, thanks for asking that. I have been studying the effect of asteroids and comets on mass extinctions in the past, and several major ones. The best-known one is the KT boundary, so-called 65 million years ago, with a major mass extinction of more than 60% of species and so on have been extinguished, largely due to climatic changes. First, the emission of dust and aerosols have resulted in freezing conditions, then the greenhouse gases emitted, released from the rocks, have resulted in longer-term greenhouse effect. And even before of that, the flash from the asteroid incinerating large areas. I became very interested in the origin of mass extinctions, and it didn't take long to look around and realize that we are living through one in terms of particularly changes in the atmosphere ocean system.
Before we get to the present and the future, I'd like to go back to the very beginning of life on Earth. Do we know when that started, and what was the planet like back then?
We don't have a date. The oldest fossils as such are 3.5 billion years old. There are older rocks, and there are some signs of organic biological material in rocks which are 3.8 billion years old in Greenland and so on, but they're rather uncertain. Now, even before that, the Earth had a crust and had volcanic activity, but we only have minerals, relic minerals from 4.4 billion years ago. We have zircons and zirconium silicate. We don't know that there was life then, but from the extremes to which microbes can adapt to in terms of temperature and pressure and so on, it's very likely that some microbial life has existed not long after the Earth has accreted, perhaps around 4.4, 4.5, but we don't really know.
And I was surprised to learn from your papers that Earth was much hotter than today for a very long time, perhaps longer than we've ever seen ice. So can you tell us what the Earth and the oceans were like in the early first billion or 2 years of our times?
Yes, well, of course, a lot is unknown. I mean, we have only a few pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. So whatever I say is subject to major questions, but to the extent that we know, well, the geothermal heat flow was certainly higher at that stage. Very thin crust and very active mantle and mantle plumes and so on. But from point of view of the atmosphere, the sun was much weaker, perhaps 25-30% weaker than it is now. So in that respect, the atmosphere and the surface did not receive the radiation it does now. On the other hand, the level of greenhouse gases, which is carbon dioxide and methane, were much higher then because there was no way for them to be absorbed by the crust and by the water. The water being warm, they don't take much carbon dioxide. There were possibly not very high mountain ranges to sequester the carbon dioxide. So even though the Earth was warmer and there were a lot of greenhouse gases, the lower effect of the sun meant that we had oceans. And the fact that we had oceans means, well, certainly temperatures were below, well below boiling point.
And then at one point in the last billion years, Earth did get a lot colder. Tell us about Snowball Earth and what happened to living things then.
Yes, the living things at Snowball Earth, which is about 700 million years ago, so they were still very primitive, mostly bacterial colonies, that's stromatolites. Well, how did Snowball Earth form? That is subject to a number of theories, but we know that, that what happened is, well, the sun was still very weak, for one thing. The levels of carbon dioxide, quite surprisingly, were not very low, but then the sun was weaker. I don't know that anyone has the final answer for the origin of Snowball Earth, and there were glaciations before then. There were glaciations at about 2,400 million years ago and so on. So I'm afraid I have to say that we don't have the final answer, although there are a number of theories.
But the whole of the seas did not freeze or anything that extreme. How far did it go, do we think?
I think that much of the Earth is frozen. I think still some ocean has remained. The thing is, this was a critical point in the evolution of life because following the Snowball Earth, the level of oxygen has risen in the atmosphere and in the oceans, and that's what allowed proteins to form, which was the basis of the more advanced animals, which leading us to about 540 million years ago, called the Cambrian explosion. It's when proliferation of animals, multicellular protein structured animals has appeared, lots of fossils of them in several areas.
So that's the beginning of Earth life forms that we might begin to recognize, and that's about 500 million years ago. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with the Australian earth scientist, Dr. Andrew Glickson. And we started talking about mass extinctions, and in earlier years, people blamed asteroids or volcanoes. You have mapped out such events in time. Are these the causes of previous mass die-offs on Earth?
Well, I think we have a fair idea now, because there's a lot of evidence. Earlier, paleontologists thought that species just reach a stage at which they somehow degenerate and die. But this is not the view of quite a number of other Earth scientists, so it's not my view. Because in just about every case in which we had a major extinction of species, we have an internal or external forcing, what we call. The internal ones being volcanic activities, they would have been of very large scale and would have polluted the atmosphere with both aerosols, that's sulfur dioxide, which causes freezing of large areas. We call it volcanic winter. The external forces were asteroids and comets, and a number of them is now recorded. The signatures of such impacts are recorded confidently in at least three cases and less directly, conclusively, in a number of other ones. The asteroid impact causes quite a number of things. First, the flash, where it enters the atmosphere of a large region, it just incinerates, causes regional fires. The second one, the seismic effect, which will just about dislodge anything around, including, well, at that stage, including mostly trees, but it would have an effect. Then the aerosols, which is dust and anything vaporized from the rocks, which means carbon dioxide, methane, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and so on, would form a concoction in the atmosphere that would first result in a, we call it asteroid winter, at short term, maybe a few years, maybe a few decades, and then a large amount of carbon dioxide should result in global warming. We have very good evidence for that now.
Are we saying, though, that these past mass extinctions required something from outer space to hit, or is it possible that the Earth itself can generate enough forces that would cause a mass extinction?
Oh, yes, the Earth itself, very, very likely, and like through volcanic events, which I mentioned before. There is a possibility that some of this volcanic effect was triggered by very large asteroid impacts. They occur in clusters. They normally occur in more than one at a time, fragments of larger bodies. So it's a combination. And in some cases, it's just the asteroid. In some cases, it's just volcanic. In other cases, it's volcanism triggered by impacts.
Well, returning to the timeline of Earth, when did today's Antarctic ice sheet begin to form, and why did that happen? Do we know?
That's actually been studied in quite a lot of detail. 35 million years ago, there was a cluster of asteroids, three of them. We found one under the Timor Sea. Very large asteroids, one of Virginia, United States, Chesapeake Bay, one in Siberia called Popeye, one under the Timor Sea. That's this for 35 million. We're not quite sure whether there is a connection between that and between what happened next, because 34 million years ago, the Antarctic split from South America through the Drake Passage. This allowed the formation of the circum-Antarctic cold current, circumpolar current, which isolated Antarctic from warmer influences of lower latitudes. In this connection, temperature drop occurred very, very fast, about 5 degrees mean global temperature drop. This is enormous. And the Antarctic form, and formed since then, the Antarctic and the circum-Antarctic polar currents and the Antarctic wind vortex formed like the refrigerator of the Earth, the thermostat of the Earth, if you like, from which cold winds and cold currents have emanated, cooling up the lower latitudes and even the tropics.
Indeed, Andrew Glickson, you have written that these polar ice caps may be necessary for the survival of mammals, including humans. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, for mammals, during the warm periods of the Earth, the so-called greenhouse phases, which is mostly the Cretaceous, which is about between 140 million and 65 million, mammals existed, but they lived as small burrowing animals underground, escaping from both the heat, because they had a different blood temperature system, and from the dinosaurs. Until sometime in the mid-Eocene, we're talking here about perhaps 40 million years ago, or 45, when conditions on Earth started to cool significantly, and the dinosaurs were gone, thanks to the large Katy boundary asteroid impact. Mammals started to appear then on the continents, and they grew very large. And the cooler the conditions, like following this strong drop in temperature at the late Eocene, 34 million years ago, the mammals have grown even larger and existed until the extinction of the megafauna, which is about approximately 10,000 years ago and attributed largely to the effect of humans.
Such as the great woolly mammoth, for example?
Yes, it's one of them.
And the saber-toothed tiger. Well, in the past million years, though, as the human species evolved, there have been serious changes in climate. Giant ice sheets buried the continents at times and then retreated. Does this tell us humans are adapted to survive climate change?
Well, we are creatures of the ice age. Humans have appeared about 3 or 4 million years ago when, further, once again, the Earth was cooling to a further extent. That's when the rainforest started to recede. The savanna, the bush, has been expanding. The grasses have emerged. And the bipeds, the humans, the primates, started to come down from the rainforest, from the trees, and populate the savanna. We are very much creatures of not just the Ice Age, but it's actually the Super Ice Age, when temperatures plunged further, perhaps 2 degrees, since about 3 million years ago, and the Ice Age have onset. It's very interesting why the Ice Age set on from that time. It appears that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was so low, oscillating between 180 and 280, that the effects of the Milankovitch cycle of the sun, the solar forcing, have been enhanced. Because otherwise, in previous period, carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases have been buffering the Earth's surface, keeping it warm, or buffering it from the, to an extent, large extent, from the effect of the sun.
Well, going back into human evolution, your paper, A Fire Species, suggests humans were changing the Earth and the atmosphere from our earliest days of capturing fire. How important was that change?
Well, this is more than important. That's the first time ever in the history of the planet that an organism, biological entity, have mastered fire. No other species does it. And by mastering fire, humans increase the energy output, and thereby the entropy in nature, and the potential energy entropy, increase the dissociation of entropy, of potential energy, by many orders of magnitude. What it means, if I can bring an example, we, as I sit here talking, I use maybe 2 calories per minute. Now, through a power generator, well, we use hundreds of thousands and millions of calories, depending on the size of the plant. That's all energy. It's dissipated, and that's affecting nature.
So we've magnified our use of fire just time and time again and until we reach the coal plant, for example.
We have magnified the use of fire as far as the biosphere is concerned, like the plants and the trees, which have been burned by prehistoric humans. But once we arrived at the stage of discovering combustion, 16th, 17th century, we have now starting to burn the remnants of previous biospheres. Biospheres, plant material disintegrated, transformed to carbon, into oil, coal and oil and gas, which formed over several hundred million years of Earth's history. So we are decarbonizing the rocks, the crust, and transferring this coal to the atmosphere. An atmosphere which is about 10 kilometers thick, breathable atmosphere, It's very much like the lungs, our lungs, which exchange the carbon and oxygen cycle, which allows life. It's the carbon and oxygen cycles which allow the biosphere to exist, plus, of course, the effect of solar radiation and the presence of water. We are decarbonizing large parts of the sediments of the previous biosphere, and we're transferring it, all those bottles, to the atmosphere. The scale of it, I think, is geological, and even today has not been perhaps fully appreciated by people.
Before we continue with the present and maybe estimate our future chances, I want to mention you also propose a theory about the role of fire in our psychology and society. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, this cannot be proven. There are many lines of evidence which render it likely, but because the relics are far and few between, it's not as perhaps confident as some of the geological observations that we have been talking about. However, burial has appeared after, that's human burial, appeared after fire was mastered. Now, part of the theory is subjective. I mean, many of us sit around campfires, and I've done it for 40 years, so we have an idea of what it's like to sit around the fire and what effect it has on the mind. But these prehistoric humans, they were sitting around campfire, which were their home, for hundreds of thousands of years. And when you combine the effect of fire, which we know directly, personally, with a time factor of hundreds of thousands of years, when fire was actually, in many instances, the human habitat around which humans sat at night. And there is a lot of evidence for it in mythologies, ancient prehistoric and historic human mythologies of fire, Prometheus, of course, but many other Indian. Then the idea develops, which to me sounds very likely, but again is hard to prove because the material relics of this development are very hard to find. That fire had an effect on the human mind, which created imagination, enhanced fear, and that this fear has then been magnified. And when humans developed agriculture, sustainable agriculture, about 8,000 years ago, they were able to express this imagination, express this fear, express their ideas of the gods in many ways, like building pyramids, going on big wars, and so on.
Well, we talk about how television or the iPhone affects our minds. It sounds reasonable that, as you say, 100,000 years or more of sitting around a campfire may also have been part of our social and mental evolution at the very least. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking with one of the experts in both Earth's history and our developing climate crisis. He is Dr. Andrew Glickson from Australia. Andrew, how fragile is our current climate situation?
It's very serious. It's so serious that I even find it hard to talk about it. It's like a pathologist looking at the blood count, white and red cells, of a seriously ill patient, and being reluctant to talk too much about it with the patient, for obvious reasons.
Why is this climate change more threatening than the previous shifts that you've studied in Earth's past?
But there were no humans then. They were very serious. The dinosaur extinction, in a way, is a climate change because the atmosphere has been shot, so to speak, first with aerosols, then with greenhouse gases. Very serious for the dinosaurs. I'm sorry for the comparison. There have been extreme climate changes in the past, but civilization was not there. There were also extreme ones when prehistoric humans lived. These people, in fact, were affected, but they had the potential of migrating to the relatively more sheltered areas, such as the rift valleys in Africa, where lakes and more water, escaping from whatever happened. The sea levels went up and down, temperatures went up and down, the ice sheets have extended and receded, but humans have migrated with the fauna. They migrated with the herds of deer and elephants and other that they actually hunted.
Well, and there were so few humans then. I've just read geneticists are thinking that it's possible at one point we came down to as few as 10 or 20,000 humans in some bottleneck. You know, there was lots of room for people to expand and live, which we don't have now. Everywhere's occupied. If a delta floods, where are a million people going to go?
Well, that's exactly right. Going back to prehistoric time just for a moment, when Mount Toba in Sumatra erupted, the extent to which the global dimming due to the sulfur aerosols has reached has resulted in a decimation of human populations. And it was during the Ice Age, during the glacial period, but it's brought temperatures even further down. So this was close to extinction, and only relatively few humans have been left. But now you're talking about the present now, right?
Yes.
Well, our civilization is anchored to a large extent in river valleys, river deltas, coastal plains, coastal cities. Our civilization is anchored on the seashores to a large extent, not entirely, which means sea levels rise. Well, that's quite something, isn't it?
Indeed. Well, you know, one of the people speaking out very strongly on our situation is Dr. James Hansen of NASA. He's one of many scientists warning the climate is more sensitive to even small changes, like 1 degree in global mean temperature, than we realized even 20 years ago. And he's pointed to the warming in the pipeline that I think you've mentioned that's hidden by our pollution. Do you think Dr. Hansen is being too extreme, or what do you appreciate about his message, if you do?
Yeah, I have read most of James Hansen's papers, which are some of the most detailed and scholarly and well-founded, consistent with the evidence, consistent with the laws of physics and chemistry. I've read many of them, and I'm afraid that I think he is correct. I also collaborated with him to some extent a few years ago through correspondence and a petition to the Australian government.
What were you asking the Australian government to do?
Well, at the time, this was Kevin Rudd's government, and James Hansen wrote a letter to the Prime Minister. We collaborated in that connection. Nothing much ensued.
As too often happens. As you know, just recently, Russian and American scientists have discovered fountains of methane rising up out of the shallow East Siberian seas, now exposed to more sunlight after the retreat of summer ice. Why are so many scientists worried about that news?
Well, methane can be expected to be released from permafrost and from shallow lakes and shallow seabed, where it's tight connected with icicles and so on, that acclutterates. It can be expected to be released, but the question is, what's the scale of this release? Methane has, when it's released, when it's fresh, some 70 times the radiative forcing than carbon dioxide. It eventually disintegrates into carbon dioxide, but it takes a number of years. And when it disintegrates, it becomes 20 times as powerful. So methane is it's a powerful greenhouse gas. The same is true for nitrous oxide, which is released from fertilizers and forms through fires and so on. Why is it so worrying? Well, it's been, in a way, predicted that this might happen, depending on the warming. But the warming in the polar region is between 2 and 4 times as high as on the continents. And that's not normally appreciated by people. People think we're only at 0.8, 0.9 degrees higher global average than before the Industrial Revolution. But in fact, we in the regions which count most, which is in the poles, where the ice is melting, it's reached 4 and 5 degrees temperature rise. It's melting the ice and melting the permafrost.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock from Australia. Our guest is scientist Andrew Glickson. We're talking about extreme climate change in the past and in our future. Given the recent record burst of carbon dioxide in 2010 and the failure of any political solution at the Durban climate talks, my question to you, Andrew Glickson, is it possible we are already committed to global warming that will endanger all coming human generations?
That's a $64 trillion question. I often wonder whether around the 1970s, actually 1975, 76, all the trajectories were steepening up, rise in the global temperature and ice melt rates and a lot of other parameters have steepened up since the time. It looks as if it might have been a tipping point, but of course tipping points are very difficult to define. I wonder whether at that point, if the global effort was made, attempted to sequester carbon dioxide, which was already, I think, 330 parts per million, whether it would have worked, that's given reforestation and even chemical sequestration of CO2. I mean, humans have put a man on the moon, and they've achieved incredible things. The question is, in that case, why not manage to sequester carbon dioxide? Because cutting an emission is no longer sufficient, it seems to me. We are now at 393 parts per million and getting close to the stability threshold or limit of the Antarctic ice sheet, which is considered 500 plus minus 50. Could humans do it in the mid-70s? Well, I hope so. And this is now, what, 30 years ago or so. This was then. Could they do it then? Now, I really don't know now. If they put the trillions of dollars which are spending on military purposes around the world into an attempt to stabilize the atmosphere, could they have done it? Well, I don't think we have an answer, but I think there would have been possibly a 50-50% chance.
Well, you know, some governments seem to accept that carbon dioxide levels will double from the pre-industrial levels. Can you tell us what that might mean in terms of climate change?
Well, governments might accept it. I don't know whether the atmosphere will accept it. That's where the huge disconnect occurs between humans and between physics, atmospheric physics and chemistry. What would it mean? Well, I'm certainly glad that I will not be around to witness that.
Do you have any figure of what you think the upper level of warming is before our civilization might collapse? I know that's quite a question to ask any scientist, but would you hazard a guess?
Well, a collapse of any civilization, including in the past, does not occur at a single point of time. It's a protracted thing, and when we look now at the spate of extreme weather events around the world, we look at the floods in Pakistan. Well, do they say it's a 1-in-100-years event? Well, this 1-in-100-years event are becoming now far more frequent, and the frequency of extreme weather events around the world has doubled over the last decade or so. That's according to numbers of the Munich Reinsurance Corporation. Or look at events like the cyclones now around the world. Look at the fires. Well, fire is another subject altogether, although closely related. I don't know that we have a single tipping point, and I don't know that we can talk about a point in time of collapse of civilization. It looks more like a series of disasters.
Andrew, it seems strange that countries like Canada, which have been hit hard by climate change, we lost all our pine forests here in British Columbia because of insect damage and the warming, and Australia has been burned and flooded in record ways, and yet both of our countries have many self-appointed experts who deny that climate change exists. Even Texas, look at that, it was burned out with a horrid drought, and they elected many, many denier politicians. How difficult is that problem for you as a scientist when you know very well what is happening to our climate?
Oh, it feels, Alex, insane. It feels as if there are a number of reasons. There are people who don't understand the scientific method. There's also, psychologically, don't accept a news of development of this magnitude. There are vested interests. But the people who deny the science, some of them go to the extent of changing the numbers on climate plots and climate trends. Now, this is something which in science, certainly in medical science, but all of science, once you've done it, you're not a scientist any longer. You're something else. It does feel insane, but it does feel, I look at this issue, as you know, to a large extent in terms of deep time. And science is a very recent development in human history. It's only developed just about from the time that actually combustion has developed, strangely enough, in the 16th, 17th century. But before then, well, we have the medieval times. We have times when superstition, the Inquisition and all the rest, all these charming ways of life and belief have existed, and we now take science for granted, but we can't. Science is a very fragile search for reality, search for the truth. It doesn't take much for humans to discard those observations which do not fit their wishes or their vested interests.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to think, you know, Francis Bacon, I think, helped develop modern science because he saw this long age of religious delusion before him, and he wanted us to test our ideas against the reality around us. And yet the politicians, and to be honest, each one of us to some degree, seem happier with our delusions about fossil fuels. I don't see a way past this fatal bottleneck right now.
Well, they don't get it, but there are real reasons why people don't get what happens, because say if it was, and I go back to asteroids, say that asteroid was approaching Earth, it would have been plain obvious that every day and every week the asteroid in the sky, which you see at night as a glowing point, is getting bigger. People would look at it and start to get worried. It's getting bigger. The same thing with the human instinct about human enemies or wars. Let's see an army building up at the border. That's obvious. That's what happened in World War II, and that's how Churchill, he was able to mobilize the British people. But with the climate and the weather, for one thing, the distinction is very difficult. Climate is a longer-term accumulation of the weather. There's some time scale. Weather is what? Days, maybe weeks. Climate is years and decades. And we live in the weather. We don't live in the climate, like day in and day out. So the problem is somewhat intractable, because also deny the science. I always speak on days and weeks at which it's nice and cool, like it is now. And people want good news. People have to live another day. Over most of the world, people have to put food on the table. We in the suburbia international, the privileged ones, where we don't want to give up our privileges, and we live in air-conditioned, climate-controlled. Modern cars have a button for climate control. So people actually believe that technology can fix everything. That's almost a form of religious belief, to think that we can populate other planets, like some people believe in that. Once the Earth is too damaged, we can always jump onto Mars and damage that too. Oh, sorry, I've been carried away.
Well, we've all been carried away, and I like where you go.
That's what you do. I mean, those who don't accept the science, the poor carbon people, they say, oh, no. They say there always have been climate changes, always have been extreme weather events. They are muddying the water by changing the data sets and by appealing to basic human needs to feel optimistic, live another day. I mean, I perfectly understand it. I very often wish that I could deny the science.
Yes, I'd like to not be broadcasting what I'm broadcasting, because it's very depressing, you know, for people.
It's very depressing. I'm sorry about it. I find it hard to talk to young people about it nowadays.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't talk to my kids about it too much. And yet we broadcast on a lot of college stations, so there are young people definitely listening, and it's their future. And I'm happy to say that there are a lot more young activists coming out and saying, we're just not going to put up with this anymore.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me sometimes that it requires people's change of mindset almost to be able to, I mean, in many areas and places, it still looks like a theoretical, like in a big city where people live in air-conditioned offices and all the rest of it. And the majority of suburbia is pretty well protected within the system that we have. And they are the people who have the resources. They're the people who have the political power. It's not the the wretched of the earth, right out there in the so-called third world or developing world, they are the ones who are suffering for more than one reason. One, they're not very well protected. They don't have the resources to protect themselves. The other, as it happens, some of these areas are the worst damaged.
Andrew Glickson, would you pick out two or three scientific papers or reports you've published in the last few months and just tell us about them?
Well, I published there was a paper called Milestone in the Evolution of the Atmosphere and Climate Change. I published it in 2008 in the Australian Journal of Air Science. There is other papers. There is a paper in the Journal of Cosmology I have about the world at 4 degrees and Homo sapiens in the atmosphere. And, well, there are other papers. I publish quite a bit on the internet nowadays as well.
And where do people find that?
There are references in the URLs, so the detailed references, I can send them to you. Like, say, if they Google in my name, Andrew Glickson, and Australian Journal of Air Science, or the Journal of Cosmology, and so on, then they will get it on the internet.
Okay, well, I'll tell listeners that that is spelled G-L-I-K-S-O-N.
That's right.
I'll post some of those links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Well, as we wrap up, I'm wondering, there must be some important things that I've missed, something else that you would like to talk about. I'll hand you the microphone. What would you like to say?
Well, thank you very much. It's about, what is it, 7,000-8,000 miles to end the microphone across. So we have to make sure it doesn't drop into the Pacific Ocean. Well, I myself, being a geologist by training, my way of to cope with the evidence is not to think that it's some particular individuals, even whether it's the billionaires nowadays or the corporations or some government, who are responsible. Even though it looks as if they are, for doing nothing and even abusing climate scientists and threatening them and all the rest, my way of thinking goes into the natural origins of the time we're living in. And like I was saying before, for a species to develop, the level of energy, which induces a level of entropy in nature, as humans have, that species will have to be capable of being responsible to the extent of almost being perfect, of not allowing this energy to get out of control and create damage in the environment. And I will have to, in ethical terms, forgive, in inverted commas, our own species for not being perfect. We would have had to be perfect to control whether it's fire, whether it's combustion, or whether it's nuclear energy for that matter, very much so. It's another form of climate change. I have to, when I think about it in terms of deep time and in terms of ethics, forgive, in inverted commas, the species for not being perfect, not being able to control this enormous power that has developed. Not something anyone designed. It's just part of evolution. Now, this helps me cope with it. Whether it's true or not is a question, philosophical or scientific question, we can always discuss. But it helps me cope with it because there is a degree of acceptance here. It's a bit like, or very much like religious people who say God has given, God has taken, be God's name be blessed. It's the same sentiment, even though not the same explanation, which sees natural evolution as the prime factor. It's very much like sailing on the sea. You see all these little waves, but really what you don't see are the deep ocean currents below, hundreds of meters below, which control the behavior of the ocean. That's the way I think, but other people and other scientists, they have their own ways of coping with the situation. A lot of them still think that if the global powers now made a decision, then the switch could be reversed, or rather, the levers could be reversed, and we will move on to stable climate.
Well, I have to agree with your assessment. I'm not a Marxist, but Karl Marx did say that he thought that the people at the top were just as deluded as the workers at the bottom. So, I don't tend to blame this politician or that politician, especially when I'm still thinking, well, gee, I would love to get on an airplane and visit with my daughter in another city. And yet by doing that, I'd be creating climate gases and making the problem worse and just deluding myself. So I'm part of the delusion. I think we all are. And whether we can change as some species wheel about, the way birds wheel about, the way fish sometimes move all together, that's kind of my hope, is that there will come a point where humans might be able to act together. We can't be perfect, but we could sure be a lot better.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, Alex. I certainly do.
Well, you've been listening to prominent Australian scientist Dr. Andrew Glickson. He's been the principal research scientist for the Australian Geological Survey Organization. Now he works with the Australian National University and the Planetary Science Institute. I'll post some links to Dr. Glickson's work in my blog at ecoshock.info. And Andrew, we've talked by email for years. It's been a real great pleasure for me to finally meet on radio.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Alex, for inviting me, and I certainly look forward to future communication, and I wish you all the very best in your very important work.
Thank you. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We go into our next climate science interview with this quick clip from michellemontecrosa.com. From the University of Washington in Seattle, our guest is William H. Calvin. He is a theoretical neurobiologist and author of a dozen books, including A Brain for All Seasons, Human Evolution and Abrupt Climate Change. Professor Calvin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to say we only have time for a brief meeting in this program. Your work is deep. I've just watched several of your full lectures on YouTube, and I barely scratched the surface. Perhaps we can talk about a few key questions. First of all, can you describe your theory that climate change helped develop the human brain?
Well, one of the big mysteries in human evolution is the increase in brain size, because our brain is about 3 to 4 times larger than that of the chimpanzees and also of the hominid ancestors back in the 6 to 3 million year time period. But then the Ice Ages started, series of climate changes, which everyone sort of imagined as being slow and gradual, and brain size started increasing then. And that's also when tool making became visible, at least in the archaeologists' collections. So this sort of triple puzzle of what did these three things have to do with one another, increasing brain size, increasing tool making, and the ice ages, you know, how do those fit together? That's where I started on the problem.
And then another striking feature of your recent presentation that I saw at the University of Victoria is, and we're moving into the present now, is the number of abrupt climate incidents in the last 40 years. Can you give us a couple of examples of that?
Okay. Scientists have been concerned about abrupt climate changes, the sort of thing where it's as fast as a drought. In other words, within just 1 or 2 years, you're in big trouble. That sort of thing was seen in the ice core records of the climate of the last ice age. In other words, it turned out not to be sort of a gradual roller coaster of temperature change, but it turned out to be superimposed on that a number of just really big jumps in climate. So, for example, it would cool down from a sort of a warm and wet climate like today into a cooler, drier, windy, dusty kind of ice age environment. And of course, the glaciers would start to respond to that by spreading. But basically, these changes only last a few centuries, and then they pop back the other direction. So, for example, it could rewarm, you know, more than 10 to 20 degrees Celsius in just 2 or 3 years. And that sort of rapid change is comes to mind in most scientists' minds when they hear the words abrupt climate change. In the last 40 years, we've had abrupt changes, but they haven't been in temperature. The ones back during the ice ages were temperature change simultaneous with drought, simultaneous with high winds and a lot of dust in the air. The ones we're having now are best recorded in drought. That is to say, a Texas-style drought in severity used to occur in about 14% of the world's land surface. Between 1950 and 1982, that was the average. There was no particular trend. It just varied from 12% up to 18% in that territory. In 1982, it suddenly doubled. And you might think that was just an exceptionally bad year of some sort, just one of those once in 2,000-year events. But it turned out that it lasted for 15 years. So it just stayed up at double. So about 28% or so of the world's land surface was in Texas-style drought in the given year. Then in 97, it jumped up to triple and stayed up at triple for about 7 or 8 years and then suddenly jumped back down to double. So we've got a series of three abrupt worldwide climate shifts. Now, local regions have these sort of, I wouldn't say all the time, but they're fairly common. It's just that you don't have so much of the world's land surface doing it all at once. It's the synchronicity of all the droughts worldwide that's the unusual feature of this. So those are three examples of abrupt, you know, climate change. And it turns out there are others that if you study the record, you recognize there's at least a half dozen that have occurred since 1976. So that's the sort of thing that we can look at the record of global warming and we can see that the temperature has been, at least since 1976, has been pretty steadily rising. And there have been a whole series of rainfall changes that have also been occurring. But drought is often a rearrangement of the rainfall patterns, not necessarily the total. Most typical way you get a drought, I suppose, is when sort of the ocean air streams that come onshore to land carry a lot of moisture, divert and go ashore someplace else. So you get a drought in the region that was normally going to get them, and you get floods in the other place.
Well, related to that, you've also said that since the Earth days of the 1970s, the green prescription to fix things has not changed very much, but our situation has become very much more serious. And you're suggesting it's too late to stick with those old solutions. Can you talk to us about that?
Okay. Well, first of all, whether you have climate change or not, you know, the green solutions represent a very logical thing to do. And it's a whole list of useful things that existed before anyone got very worried about climate. Climate is just an additional reason to do them and do them quickly. I mean, what I'm suggesting now is that we have accumulated so much more CO2 in the air since the 1970s that simply stopping doing what caused it is no longer a good solution, because the CO2 stays in the air. You've got to do something to take it out of the air if you want the temperature to come back down in time, you know, for, say, your children's or grandchildren's generation, you know, to profit from it. In other words, the prescription that was perfectly logical for climate coincided very much with the general green agenda. And if things had been done back in the 70s, so we wouldn't have the accumulation that we now have to get rid of. So what I'm suggesting is we have a big cleanup job to do. If, in fact, all the gradual things of the general green agenda is going to work, what I'm suggesting is you really have to do a quick fix now to keep the world from having abrupt climate changes and all the other stuff that's begun to bother us big time.
I'm afraid we are running out of time. We have been talking with Professor William H. Calvin from the University of Washington. You can find out a lot more with links to his videos at williamcalvin.com or search his name on YouTube. Professor Calvin, I know that I'd like to have you back and really talk about these issues in depth. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
We'll be talking with Dr. William Calvin again next week after I play you one of the most shocking climate speeches of 2011, an outlook so grim I didn't want to play it for you during the holidays. For now, I just want to point you to a YouTube speech by Bill Calvin at the University of Victoria. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.info or just search William Calvin on YouTube. I also liked this quick introduction to that speech by Bill Calvin, and it was by Dr. Colin Campbell, another Aussie currently working on wild salmon in British Columbia, and he's chair of the Sierra Club of BC.
Dr. William Calvin, our guest today, is a professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and he's affiliated with its program on climate change. He's most recently the author of a book, Global Fever, How to Treat Climate Change, and he's written at least 13 other books for general audiences, averages one every 2 years. Think of that. His studies have included brain circuitry, ape-to-human evolution, climate change, and civilization's susceptibility to abrupt shocks. And he brings with him a lifetime of reflection on the great problems, the great questions of our time. He's worked on the leading edge of interdisciplinary practice. But most importantly, Bill brings some substance to what we've all come to realize, and that is that the behavioral challenge in meeting climate change is equal, if not greater, than the technical challenge of implementing the solutions that we've developed. If we don't really want to do what has to be done, and if we can't properly manage our motivation, then we surely will not succeed. Now, a great proportion of Dr. Calvin's research and writing has served to inform us about our neurophysiology, our brain and our minds. And this is information that we need. I know from my own experience as a paleontologist that any interest in biological evolution immediately leads to an interest in climate, especially the climate history and the mechanisms of climate change. Because climate, more than anything else, routinely shifts the environment that all species must evolve to match. And it could be said from the point of view that species, well, let's say it this way, that the climate is the question to which species are the answer. And the species that's best answered the call of abrupt climate change is the human species. And Professor Calvin has really fully developed this simple notion in his really wonderful book called A Brain for All Seasons, Human Evolution and Abrupt Climate Change. This is an engaging account at many levels, but none more so than in recognizing that the conditions which brought about the evolution of humanity are similar to the kind of stresses that we're imposing on the planet ourselves right now. And it adds extra meaning, I suppose, to our notion of meeting our maker.
Climate change as our maker. I'm Alex Smith. Find out more on our blog at ecoshock.info. plus our videos and tons of free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Join us next week as we find out just how tough that climate maker can be. Thank you for listening, and feel free to pass this program on to others who need to know.